Talk given Friday, 7th August 1981. We all know that all human beings, with extremely rare exceptions, go through a great deal of suffering. And in this suffering, they can't find the solution to it. In the different ways in which the world offers solution. So perhaps they take to religion in the hope that it will help them to bear, perhaps even to be free of their suffering. That is one aspect of it. Another aspect is that people are afraid of the hereafter, and they have been told that if they lead a good life, meaning a religious life, if they lead a life which puts them in right relationship with God, they will have happiness after death. And if they have not done so and led an evil life, they will have unending sorrow after death. So they are afraid. And this fear often moves them to take to religion. To take to religion in a reasonably serious sense, to live the good life, to live the religious life. Then again, there are those who are born with a natural curiosity with regard to the hereafter, and they ask questions from childhood onwards, and they are given answers about it, and these answers introduce elements which are not elements of ordinary everyday experience. They are supernatural, super outside the ordinary range of worldly experience. The parents, teachers, friends perhaps, and various others talk to them about God, about heaven, about an extraordinary state and this, that and the other. And so they come to believe that, and they associate the word God with other questions that they ask: who made me, who made you? And so the regress goes on, and who made that, and who made that, and the distracted parent finally says, God made everything, and the child asks, who made God? And the child is told that God was there always from the beginning and will everlastingly be. And the whole idea of something forever and ever is something very strange, after all, to the child mind. Because the child doesn't experience anything forever and ever in its everyday life. If it likes chocolates, it cannot eat chocolates forever and ever, and so on. So these are strange ideas which are presented to the child. But the child's aesthetic sense often responds to these ideas. And of course they, particularly to the idea that if one lives the good life, then one will have happiness in heaven forever and ever. And that has a very powerful influence upon the child, upon the child mind. And so the child proceeds further with its inquiry as to how should the child live? And of course the usual thing is that one is presented with the conventional idea of worshipping God, and of course with the simple moralities, must be truthful, you must be kind and loving and good and so forth, you must obey your parents and your teachers and so on, you see. So the whole system of morality and of belief and worship which that child's own particular society possesses is instilled into the child. And so the child takes to religion, but it takes to it only in a somewhat superficial form, just the externals of religion, to go to the temple and worship, or go to church and pray and that sort of thing. And the aesthetic aspect has a very great influence. And this is particularly so in Christendom, because the Christian, generally speaking, the Christian worship is the most highly developed artistic congregational worship that there is in the world. I don't know any other system, any other religion which has a system so appealing. All the arts are combined. Isn't that so? The beauty of the church itself, the stained glass windows, the ceremonial, the singing, and the robes and all that sort of thing has a very powerful influence, and it is by no means a wrong influence or an evil influence as such. It sort of gives the child a sense of uplift, a sense of something which is very nice. The child can only think in terms of what is very nice and very pleasant, after all, isn't it? So all this is very pleasant, and perhaps the child daydreams that if I live this good life all my life, go to church and pray and be a good girl or be a good boy, then I shall enjoy this everlastingly in the other place. That sort of feeling is instilled into the child. And as the child grows up and its intellectual side develops too, and asks more and more serious questions and starts studying and all that study conditions the mind. The child is ready to believe. This is the important thing to bear in mind, that the tendency of the child and of the adolescent too is to believe, not to challenge what is being told, because the starting point was something which produced pleasure, happiness, lovely thing, going to church and singing and so forth, and then the church parties and everything that is associated with what is considered the religious life is pleasant. And so long as that is the case, well then the child is very willing to believe and to be conditioned, without being at all conscious in any serious measure, that it is being conditioned to believe. Rarely a child will challenge what is told. And then comes the unfortunate aspect. He or she is more or less made to feel, no, that is wrong, you mustn't challenge these things, mustn't ask questions about that. You must believe all the things that your religion tells you, you see. But of course this is merely religion in the outward form. However, it is acceptable, so the child takes to it, and its aesthetic sense, and its sense of security is involved in it. Now with grown-ups too, when grown-ups suffer and seek the assuagement of their pain. They are seeking security. They are seeking something which will give them hope, something which will make them feel that life is worthwhile living, and so forth. And so they take to it. And of course, a great many of the conventional teachings of the religions of the world, all over the world, they have a great deal of thoughtful substance to them, and it is acceptable to the man in the street and the woman in the home. So they keep to it, and they do believe that by living this kind of life, the life on earth here, the worldly life, will also be a happy and a successful one. There is this very powerful element of wanting to be successful in life, successful in running the home and doing things well, success in business, success in one's profession, success in bringing up the children, in acquiring property. All this is sort of finds its way into their idea of being religious. The religious person is the person who should never be in poverty, never want money. And it is rather interesting that in the Christian world, for instance, perhaps the Quakers are an example of being very well off as a particular religious group on the whole. You don't find that so strongly in the other religions. And although all the religions have extolled poverty, chastity, obedience, the people of the world have never really understood what is the meaning of this poverty or chastity or obedience. Take the word obedience. The whole world today, with the exception of a very few intelligent people, thinks of obedience as conforming to what you're told to do by your superior, your employer, by your teacher, and by the statements which are given in the scriptures of the world, to obey, just do what you're told, what you're ordered to do. But the word obedience comes from ob and audire. Audire meaning to hear, to listen. Now, obedience in the religious life means precisely that. To listen. Listen to what? To listen to your own inner voice, and also to listen to everything and everybody around you. Of course, it's rather a hard thing to do when you get a person come along monologuing about the most uninteresting things and so on. But still, to be able to listen to that person often calms that person down. He or she comes to the end of her monologuing after a time. One has to be therefore very, very quiet and silent. And this element of silence is, of course, very much bound up with the real meaning of obedience. Also, the meaning of chastity. Chastity is associated with sexual morality, almost exclusively with sexual morality. But that is not the case. To be chaste means to be clean, to be pure. See, and this purity is not a matter which is confined to the sexual aspect of life. It's not confined to that. It occurs in every possible way, in one's thought, feeling, action, speech, to be pure, to be clean, which involves also to be harmless. It involves being truthful. It involves doing things skillfully, beautifully. Then that is chastity, if you like, the real chastity, which of course will include the aspect of sexual morality too. And poverty, non-possessiveness, freedom from greed, which is very difficult, because the organism, the psychophysical organism, descended as it is from a primordial animal ancestor, has the original drives for self-preservation, for self-gratification also involved in it, you see, and for the preservation of the species. So all these things are tied up very strongly. This element of self-gratification plays perhaps the strongest part in the lives of most human beings. They want to, because they are ruled by egoism, by vanity, by ignorance. So they want to gratify their lust for possessions, for power, for sex, for excitement, sensational pleasure, and all the rest of it. And this plays a very, very powerful part in human life. And after all, when you come to look at the world today, particularly today after the Second World War, you find that the human race seems to have gone crazy chasing sensational excitements, delights, and pleasures, with no consideration at all as regards the consequences, both to themselves and to all others. The breakdown of the family ideal, for instance, is one of the saddest features of the modern world. Because the family is the complete, perfect unit of society which represents the individual himself. No individual is an individual unto himself, unrelated to anybody else. Every person is a true individual insofar he is either the child or the mother or the father of a single group. The biological unit is the family, not the particular single individual organism. This is something which the world is just beginning to wake up to. You may have heard of the Peckham experiment, which was carried out by two very intelligent doctors, Dr. Scott Williamson and Dr. Innes Pierce, you see. And they were concerned not so much with dis-ease and overcoming of symptoms, but with the real meaning of health, health in terms of wholeness, you see. And so membership of all those who participated in that Peckham Health Experiment was never the membership of a lone individual. It was the whole family. The whole family were members of this group. And of course, they had thousands of people coming in and supporting the idea. And they did some very, very good work indeed. Now, if people can awake to that, there is the starting point for beginning to realize selflessness, which is one of the hallmarks of true religiousness. Real selflessness, not the ordinary type of unselfishness, which is inculcated in us as a virtue. We must be unselfish. There you see the authoritarian aspect. We must be. But if the natural tendency of the psychophysical organism, which is an animal organism after all, is to be concerned for self. And I must be so unselfish, especially when one is young and full of lusty life. Lusty in every sense of the word lusty. You see. It's extremely difficult to be unselfish. And all the animal instincts are at play, especially, for instance, between the relationships between the sexes. Males will fight each other just like animals do, and females not like animals do. That's the astonishing thing. Females don't fight for a male. They just sit quietly and watch. The male, which is the victor, has the lady. But here it's very different. In the human species, it's something altogether strange. So that we are not good animals in that respect, but we are beasts. Our behavior can be bestial. No ordinary animal is bestial. Have you noticed that? They live entirely in tune with the laws of nature. It is man who has the power to raise himself up against nature or against God or against his fellow man or society. That's why he's such a predator and a plunderer and a destroyer. He's the agent of the Lord of Death, who delivers the wages of sin. He himself is the sinner, and he himself is the agent who delivers the wages of sin, death, disease, death, and so forth. Well, we have to understand all these things, and then we'll realize that man turns to religion when he finds himself unable to cope with life, unable to solve his problems, deal with his difficulties, and so he turns to religion. But whilst this happens in with very many people, if one turns to religion in order that one may find safety or assuagement of pain for oneself, or have a guaranteed insurance in the other world after one is dead, then that life is not a religious life at all. He may do all sorts of good things, he may think noble thoughts, and any fool can do that. Think noble thoughts. or deliberately participate in whatsoever elevates him or gives him a sublime experience or this, that, or the other. He'll even take drugs in order to have a trip into spiritual realms, as he miscalls them, and so forth. He'll do all that, but it is self-oriented. And it is not selfless. That is to say, he is still completely the slave of his sense of separate selfhood. It is this sense of separate selfhood which is the very devil in us. I am different from you, true enough, in certain characteristics and so forth, which is perfectly natural and proper, because it makes for the infinite variety, which is the marvel and the beauty of the whole universal process as such. But not only am I different from you, but I am separate from you forever and ever. And he believes in his own immortality, just as the other fellow from whom he is separate also believes in his own immortality as such. So there is always the disharmony which denies the unity of the universe, and that is sin in the real sense. But people don't see that, so they take to religion, they take to various religious practices, whatever they may be, in order that they may individually find happiness, success, fulfillment, and the gratification of all that they seek, which is, of course, serving one's own lust, actually. So it behoves us, when we take to religion and all the various elements which constitute the religious life, It is very important that we should question ourselves. Why are we doing this? Why am I doing this? How am I doing it? You see? And if we really look into ourselves, we shall weep many tears. The discovery of truth comes always, sears the soul at first. But it is that searing of the soul which burns out the evil. Now this is an actual fact of our spiritual existence and growth. And some religions have not presented it in quite the right way. I have in mind particularly Christianity. The Christian teaching sort of invites suffering, believing that this is because the Lord is looking after me and sending all these trials to me to try me out and see whether I succeed in overcoming these things and therefore become worthy of the Lord. But you see, there's a tremendous vanity and egoism and self-seeking involved in all that, very, very subtly involved in it. Extremely difficult to penetrate. Extremely difficult. And it is a strange thing that the religion which was founded by him who was called the Prince of Love, that Christendom has been responsible, like Islam too, of some of the cruelest and the most terrible inhuman things in human history. The sphere of Hinduism, of Buddhism, of Zarathustrianism has not been guilty of such terrible things. They have made their mistakes too, and they have done wrong things too, simply because, after all, they are psychophysical organisms like Christian or Islamic psychophysical organisms, and so they have made their mistakes and continue to make their mistakes yet. But the fact remains that when one really sees the truth about oneself and comes to know oneself in actual fact, it first shocks us terribly. But this shock is a good thing. If we are worth our salt, so to say, we will really deal with that shock and that shocked state. You see? We will deal with that shocked state. We will not run off to our friend, our teacher, our guru, or anything, and say, "Oh, Master, what am I to do now?" No, we will be quiet. You see? After all, it's a little bit like this. If you are walking along the street and you come into a foggy patch, well, you have to deal with that yourself. You might perhaps get a lift from somebody or whatever it is, but on the whole, you have to deal with it yourself when the problem comes up. If you don't deal with it yourself, then you do not grow from within in perceptivity, in intelligence, or in the qualities which characterize the person who is really becoming human, growing into humanity, growing out of his, outgrowing his subhuman state. This is very important. So, when this sort of searing comes, be grateful to fate for its coming. Sometimes life plays a peculiar trick in connection with the religious life. I think I mentioned earlier that some are born with a natural feel towards the transcendent, towards something that is supernatural, something that is marvelous, something that belongs to the context of eternity and beauty and harmony and all the rest of it, you see. Some are born like that, they take to it, they are gifted in certain ways, and their lives are lives in which they are growing closer and closer to that state. Then, 60, 70 years of age, and things happen, things come along, and they find that all their rosy conceptions about themselves were incorrect, that they were false. And then the shock is really very, very terrible. I know people like that. And they have no one to help them. Because everyone has been looking forward to them for assistance with their difficulties and so forth. And here, the great one who was set up on a pedestal has fallen. And he himself can't understand it. Also, his powers are failing because of age. But this is really a supreme opportunity. You all know the phrase, the dark night of the soul, and going through the valley of the shadow of death. When this happens in old age, it is really terrible. But if one can maintain inward poise, then one realizes sainthood during one's lifetime. The maintenance of this inward poise is a question of being able to see in which ways one had gone wrong all along, right from the beginning, with respect to his attitude towards mankind as a whole, towards those who with whom he came in touch, and so forth. And he will discover that his attitude was self-concerned all the time. Success is a terrible enemy of religiousness. Particularly including success in the religious life as such, to start with. You see. Then he will gradually, if he can really stand that shock, deal with it, and see into himself, he will realize that the whole of the religious life was not meant for gaining anything at all in any sphere of life. Material, psychological, social, spiritual, it was not meant for gaining anything, not meant for receiving honors and respect from those with whom he came in contact. It was not meant for success in any spiritual practices, meditation or yoga or whatever it may be. Was not meant for that, but to realize that state of complete freedom of mind, unshakable freedom of mind. Unshakable freedom of mind meaning that he realizes that he has no mind of his own as such. That his task consisted only in utterly purifying the psyche. But success had all his young years and middle age and so forth had spoilt his vision of the reality. But it is, of course, possible that for that person to emerge out of that. And if he can emerge out of that, especially in old age, he can be utterly free in himself. Free in the real sense, knowing that real freedom begins at the peak point of self-restraint and self-understanding. Then there is real self-understanding, not the sort of understanding which you get from conventional psychology and from psychiatrists and all the rest of them. They don't know. They know the sick soul. But where the soul is concerned, no other soul can heal you. Unless that other soul is a perfected holy one. This is the very important thing. And if one is fortunate enough ever to meet with such a person, then the influence of that person is such that it works the miracle in one's soul and completely purifies it. This is the fundamental meaning of all the miracles which are attributed to the holy ones. It's the fundamental meaning, this complete purification of the psyche which is brought about. And the whole, one's whole consciousness is there's a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. And one is aware of truth and of reality without making any mistakes about it. Then the senses and the sense avenues through which most of the trouble arose, the sense avenues become cords of communion. I think practically all the religions of the world, perhaps bar Zarathustrianism, yes, I should say bar Zarathustrianism, all the religions of the world have presented quite a wrong view about the senses. Beware of the senses. They are the deceivers. The senses are not the deceivers at all. The senses are mere avenues, mere doors and windows. It is the psyche which, because it is both physical and non-physical in nature, we must never forget that the psyche is material. It's half material, it's half spiritual. You see? It's rooted in solid flesh and blood. It's rooted in that. And every activity which we call psychical or psychological is associated with electrochemical activity throughout the body. It's associated. It can't get away from it. See? This is something which we have forgotten. So one shouldn't think in terms of overcoming evil, destroying that which is harmful to one's spiritual growth and so forth. It's entirely mistaken. You can only transform the thing. Because there is nothing which can be annihilated in the real sense. Science has come to the point where it knows that what is called a particle and what is called an antiparticle can annihilate each other. But that is to say, they annihilate their separate existence as particles. But the result of that annihilation, when they bump together, is that they have just radiated out as energy, heat, light, and so forth. So there is no loss in any sense anywhere. This is something very important. The old people didn't know this. So they talked in terms of strive against the evil, and strive to do good. Now that is the sort of statement which they couldn't avoid making. Even the Buddha said that sort of thing. He said, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. I would put it in quite different terms nowadays. You can't purify the mind. Mind is something transcendent. It is pure, it is a pure energy. Psyche. Individuals have a psyche. Individuals have no mind. But when the psyche is purified, because the psyche owes its existence to the interaction of universal mind with universal corporeality, the body. Psyche owes its existence to that. It is the psyche which we can purify. And then if the psyche is purified, then good is naturally done. And one has naturally ceased from evil. And then pure mind functions through the individual as such.